Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Two guests for you today. Ken Walk on the 100th birthday of the visionary who coined the phrase the global village and who was one of the first people to see how mass media has changed us all. And then something much more primitive. A woman who was once a vegetarian who learned how to go into a forest and hunt and kill a wild boar for food. First, the global village. There's this great moment in the Woody Allen film Annie Hall where Woody Allen's waiting in line to see a film. He's with Diane Keaton and he's getting increasingly irritated by this blowhard who's just nattering away directly behind him in the queue.
It's the influence of television. Yeah, now, Marshall McLuhan deals with it in terms of it being a hot medium.
What I wouldn't give for a large sock as with horse manure in it.
And then Woody Allen kind of turns to the camera and appeals directly to the cinema audience.
What do you do when you get stuck on a movie line with a guy like this behind you?
Wait a minute, why can't I give my opinion? This is a free country?
He can give you. You have to give it so loud. I mean, aren't you ashamed to pontificate like that? And the funny part of it is, Marshall McLuhan, you don't know anything about Marshall McLuhan's work.
Really? I happen to teach a class at Columbia called TV, Media, and Culture. So I think that my insights into Mr. McLuhan will have a great deal of validity.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that's funny because I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here.
And at that point, Woody Allen just goes and he goes and gets Marshall McLuhan himself, who's just off camera, and then he drags him over.
Come over here a second.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Boy, if life were only like this.
Clearly, Marshall McLuhan was not only a great thinker, but a good sport as well. Even today, people quote and misquote this man all the time. It's the 100th anniversary of the birth of Marshall McLuhan, who was one of the most provocative minds of the last century. He was one of the few people who was really paying attention to what was happening to us when TV and radio became part of the furniture of our lives. Marshall McLuhan coined all sorts of phrases about this new mass media world that are still with us today. The global village, the age of anxiety, and his most famous one-liner, the medium is the message. All this is by way of introduction to Mackenzie Walk, who's sitting with me at the moment. Ken Walk is an Australian, but over a decade ago, he moved to New York City, where he's become an influential thinker, on that place where media, culture, and politics meet. Ken Walk is currently Associate Professor of Media and Culture at the New School for Social Research in New York City, and he's back in Australia for a few weeks as part of the ABC's special McLuhan Project to talk about the ideas and influence of this dapper Canadian gent. Ken Walk, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Richard.
What do you know about the background of this very charming, well-dressed man? Because he's quite a conservative-looking guy, isn't he?
Yeah, well, I'm tempted to say, I know nothing of his work, like the guy in the queue, you know. But so he was born 100 years ago in the plains of Canada. His mother taught elocution, which I always thought was an interesting detail. When you listen to him speak, you know, there's a amazing quality to the way he enunciates everything.
Yeah, you can hear it, can't you? You can hear those rounded vowels.
Yeah.
So an interest in language right from the start. Then.
Yes.
And what language means and what happens when you pick words apart and how they're sort of assembled together to change the kind of furniture of reality. He came from quite a religious family, a Protestant religious family. Did he maintain his religious belief throughout his life?
No, his parents belonged to different versions of Protestantism. His mother dabbled in Christian Science, I think, as well. But he converted to Catholicism. And that, I think, is a central part of the making of Marshall McLuhan.
Why?
It gave him a certain perspective. You know, famously, he ran this centre at University of Toronto, and he would sort of show up there dutifully every morning. He would, you know, walk to work and do that. And then he would walk over to the cathedral for a mass every single day. So there's a sort of communicating with the eternal part of McLuhan, and it gives him a sort of bemused quality in kind of looking at the rest of us. But the other strand of it is, I think, for McLuhan, there's a certain kind of knowledge that comes through thinking through analogy, and he wanted to restore the role of that.
Like Bible stories, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, and there's centuries, he knew this because it's in his PhD thesis, there's kind of centuries of constructing knowledges of the word, and at different times, different parts of it are dominant, and they're essentially rhetoric, you know, the art of persuasion, dialectic, which is the kind of the interactive piece, and grammar, which is the ability to read. So it's sort of reading, writing, interacting, to put it in really simple terms. But there's thousands of years of tension between these different parts of knowledge. And he essentially wanted to, if you like, change the balance, to restore a kind of poetic, rhetorical form into sort of public discourse, and he did.
At the beginning, one of the Gospels, it begins with that famous phrase, "In the beginning there was the Word," and it's a really interesting part of the Bible because it says, it goes on to pretty much say that the world was created out of language in a weird sort of way. You can see that influence on his thinking too, can't you, Ken?
Yeah, well, and actually one has to say it's before the Bible, that's Plato. This is Greek thought, is the idea of logos, is the sort of the intelligibility of the world in language. But it's a key to both philosophy and certain kinds of faith, in a sense. The other thing about McLuhan is that he thought that we had shifted out of a print-based universe into what he would call electric media that was involving and in-depth and auditory and visual and all these other things. You can read in that a kind of distancing from the thing that, you know, print is most associated with, which is Protestantism. You know, there's a sense in which he's conducting an argument, you know, through the centuries with Protestantism and restoring a sense of what the mass in mass media should be. It's no accident we talk about mass media. You know, it's the mass. It's the idea of you're sitting there in church, there's light blazing through the stained glass windows, the choir is pumping away, there'll be a liturgy, probably in a language you don't even speak. So it's working on all the senses at once. So I think for McLuhan, this is a central part of thinking about media, is connected back through the centuries. He's thought to be a really modern guy, but he's really also talking about something quite traditional.
So he starts to take an interest in TV and radio and mass media, as you say. Do you think he's sort of starting to see people aren't really congregating so much in churches anymore, but are congregating around the idiot box, as it was called back then?
Well, he was influenced by people like Ezra Pound, who he sought out after the war, and Pound was a sort of forgotten figure at that time because he'd been compromised by fascism. He sought out Wyndham Lewis. And these guys were what you might think of as sort of reactionary right-wing but modernist. They weren't, you know, particularly nostalgic and backward-looking and clinging to traditions. They were sort of reinventing them, but they had a middle-class, in the narrow-minded sense actually, view of the political world, wedded to this incredibly vast cultural knowledge. So they're kind of curious figures, this sort of right-wing version of modernism. And McLuhan builds on that. A lot of his stuff, particularly Global Village, it comes from Wyndham Lewis. It's kind of building on this previous tradition.
When TV came along and really started to be bought up in massive numbers after the Second World War, particularly in America, a lot of creative people and artists and academics and thinkers recoiled in horror. You know, they're watching, you know, Three Stooges and seeing things like that and tons of advertising on TV, and just said, this is a blight on us and we're not interested in it and we hate it and we just want it to go away. Was he one of the first people, Marshall McLuhan was one of the first people to actually say, no, this is interesting, we need to think a bit more about this?
Yeah, and that's, in a sense, this is part of his greatness, is that he managed to bracket off the kind of fairly small-minded, self-interested approaches that the literate class would tend to have to this sort of thing, even though he's profoundly of the literate classes. He's someone with, you know, who studied at Cambridge, who reads books. But he would sort of look at this thing and think about how is it creating an environment. He would look at television and not just see the program on it. He would see the environment that television was making. And that was a really quite astonishing thing to be able to do.
It's hard to look back now and remember this, because since a lot of the medium that he was writing about is starting to die. But it's hard to recall the level of panic there was around TV when it started to become a mass medium.
I mean, television created both panic and euphoria, is the thing. There was also the argument that it would be this like fantastic democratizizing force for culture. That the same arguments have been made about radio, that everyone would understand, you know, the great classics of classical music because we would all have radio, we'd all be listening to Beethoven, you know. The same argument got made about television, that it would be this wonderful educating force.
Yeah, we'd all be watching wildlife documentaries around the
exactly.
clock, that
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah. And the thing is, and McLuhan identifies that, yeah, television is extraordinarily influential, just not in the way you think it is. Like, you have to think about the form of it before you think about what's on it. To him, it's sort of, it doesn't matter anymore what's on television than it matters what's in any individual phone call. It's the way that television or telephony shape a kind of a space, an environment that you then slip into. And like most other things about environments, you don't really notice anymore.
I want to bring in an interview with Marshall McLuhan now that was recorded by ABC TV when he came to Australia in the 1970s in a program called Monday Conference, where he's talking about this very thing. Was this the first time you encountered the thinking of Marshall McLuhan way back in the 70s, Ken?
It was. And like a lot of people of my era, you know, the ABC was my education in a lot of ways, and something McLuhan would have predicted. And I saw Monday Conference because my family watched the ABC religiously, like a certain kind of middle class used to do. And I vividly remember some phrases from this show and of him appearing on Monday Conference with Robert Moore, who was the host of it.
Okay, here's the first question that was thrown at him by Robert Moore.
When you say the medium is the message, does that leave any room at all for criticism of individual, say, television programs?
Or content.
Yes.
You see, it doesn't much matter what you say on the telephone. The telephone as a service is a huge environment, and that is the medium. And the environment affects everybody. What you say on the telephone affects very few. And the same with radio or any other medium. What you print is nothing compared to the effect of the printed word. The printed word sets up a paradigm, a structure of awareness, which affects everybody in very, very drastic ways. And it doesn't very much matter what you print as long as you go on with that form of activity.
Tell me a bit more what he's thinking about there. Just explain a bit more about what he's talking about there. It doesn't matter what you say on the phone. What matters is the phone call. It doesn't matter what you print. What matters is the medium in which it comes through. Is he saying it doesn't really matter what you say in a speech? It's the decor of the room in which you make the speech? Or it doesn't matter what's on the page? It's the font it's printed in? Is that what he's saying here, Ken?
I mean, that's a little bit true. You know, whenever you see the President of the United States speak, you know, you know what he's going to say is not going to be terribly interesting. You can kind of predict what it is. It's the fact that he is speaking behind the lectern in the Rose Room or wherever it happens to be. You know, there's a sense in which we tend to sort of focus in on the content and forget the form in which it occurs. I mean, people get that when you build freeways, you start to reshape the space of a city or a suburb. But we don't really quite notice that when you put cell phone towers on all the buildings in that suburb, you've also changed the space in a really quite radical way. And we don't really quite grasp that we inhabit these media environments.
So after the war, there's this headlong rush into these new electronic mediums like TV and of course, radio had already been there. And what you're saying is he was sort of saying, just hang on a minute, what are we doing to ourselves when we do this? What were the consequences of this headlong rush into a new world of mass media, as he saw it then, Ken?
He thought, and the thing about this is that it always works by the contrast. So he'll say, you know, the thing about print media is that it sort of divides things up, you know, in the same way that it's divided up into the letters on the page and so on. So there's a kind of dividing up analytic mode of thinking that print encourages in you. And you construct a sort of internal distance within yourself in relation to the word on the page. But electric media, as he called it, you know, broadcasting, it's sort of immersive. It sort of surrounds you. So your relation to it, even your bodily physical relationship to it, is different to what it is in the printed world. Now, you can say that reading of print is a little bit actually kind of narrow and even a bit silly. But it's the contrast is the thing. So I don't know that any of his particular figures about how this media is a hot one, that one's a cool one, I don't know if the actual descriptions work all that well. But what he does is start getting you to think about that there's actual contours to a media landscape. You know, just as if you look out your window, you can see, you know, valleys and hills and fields and things like that. There's a shape to the media landscape, and each particular technology transforms the shape of it in quite particular ways.
As someone who worked in a long time in TV and has now worked in radio for some years, a really bad mistake that people can sometimes make is to assume that they're easily interchangeable, because I now know they're not. They're completely different mediums, radio and TV. You can make one sort of interchange, but what you'll get is often bad TV and bad radio out of that process. You mentioned there he said that TV was a cool medium and radio is a hot medium, and you can hear that guy getting it wrong in any hall as well. Mm. What does he mean by that? Cool and hot. TV cool, radio hot.
And I got to say, this is the part of his thing that I always find kind of nuts. I can never quite get it to work. But it's really got to do with, to what extent is it a medium that impresses itself upon you, or is it a medium that you kind of take yourself to? Like, that would, in a sense, be the kind of difference. And you know, I've never quite got, you know, why is this one hot and that one cool, you know? And you have to remember that the television he's talking about is sort of like black and white American television of the 50s with this like grainy, spotty sort of thing where you really had to kind of decode what was going on in the image half the time. You know, it's like, is that a face, you know, there through the TV snow? It's not the high definition, you know, big screen thing that we might look at now. But I think the intuition is right, that different media work in different ways. So one of the things about radio is that you can do other stuff while you listen to it. You can drive, you can do the laundry, you can set the table, you can chop vegetables, and you have company. You have these kind of voices in your life. And people, I think, seek out particular kinds of company from radio in a way that television really doesn't quite work that way. And particularly the kind of radio we're doing, which is conversational. It's this model of here's you know, you have good and bad conversations during your day, but if you've got a choice, you want to turn on a good one and fill your space with that, where people aren't sort of yelling at you or anything like that. So radio, I think, has quite particular attributes. And it's not to say that if you have this media technology, it automatically means you get this particular kind of effect. Is that there's a space of possibility within any media.
Yes, embedded strengths within that medium.
Right.
If you know what you're doing, you can work with.
Yes. Radio is also Adolf Hitler, right? It's not just one thing, but there's a space of possibility, and it's different for television. But then it's different when you start to change television, and it becomes internet-based and big screen and all that sort of stuff. So even internally within media, they kind of shift.
My guest today in conversation is Mackenzie Walk. Ken Walk is back in Australia for a couple of weeks as part of the ABC's special Marshall McLuhan projects, and he's currently Associate Professor of Media and Culture at the New School for Social Research in New York City. One big difference between TV and radio, I'm not quite sure if he had anything to say about this, it's certainly the way it is these days, the remote control changes a lot of things. Most times people consume TV, they might be in their underpants, I don't know, sitting back on a couch with a remote in hand, poised over the channel changer, going, nah, nah, oh yeah, oh no, oh yeah. It's kind of low commitment most of the time. And what comes at you has high impact, but it sort of comes at you. Radio is more beguiling. As you say, there's multitasking going on, and it seems to almost come to you like a voice in your head. Did Marshall McLuhan notice that? Did he talk about that?
He was very interested in orality, and when I say there's a group of thinkers around him, that there's a moment in human history where orality is what binds us together.
What storytelling do you mean?
Yeah, well, that's not the only thing one does with the oral, but that's a key part of it. But if you just think about the sense of hearing itself, that, you know, one hears in stereo, so you're oriented in the space, but you hear the whole space, right? And you sort of focus in on part of what you hear, but the rest of it is kind of still there, but it surrounds you. It's a little bit different to the way the visual field works, that you're only seeing a fraction of what's in front of you. You don't see what's behind you.
So radio is more 3D in that sense?
In a way, yeah. I mean, both are obviously stereoscopic, and I'm not a physiologist, so I can't really speak to that. But I think from everyday experience, we know that, you know, you sort of experience a kind of surround sound no matter where you are, but the visual field is different and specific, and the way you focus within it is different. So for McLuhan, that was kind of key, that orality had certain qualities. And it was interrupted by the printed word first. The print takes you out of that world of simultaneity and immersion and starts to sort of chop things up. But that some of it had returned through radio, and that there's, if you like, a new extension of the body into the visual realm that was television. And one he doesn't quite get to, but you'd have to talk about now, is, you know, there's, if you like, a kind of secondary literacy built on top of televisual and broadcasting sensibility, and it's Twitter and Facebook and text messaging and all that sort of stuff, is that far from going away, we've actually reinscribed the written word, but out of the print context into a completely new context.
Whenever there's a new medium, and we've seen this certainly with the internet, you know, in our lifetimes, as I mentioned before, there's a fair degree of panic that can well up in the community. But there's also another group of people who'll often be the kind of breathless enthusiasts for the change and say, come on, people, get with the program. This will be like drinking from the fire hydrant. Bring it on. Mm. Grow up. Get with the picked scene. You know, move on with the times. Where did Marshall McLuhan stand in this new, as he saw TV suddenly become such a massive part of the lives of Americans, Canadians, and indeed Australians? Was he worried about it, Ken?
he wanted to not say or do the obvious things about it, is what's really kind of interesting about his reaction to it. I think he was privately pretty horrified by most of, you know, what had happened to Western civilization in his lifetime. You know, he's not, you know, there was a kind of a mistake about him. But the thing is, he censors out any kind of moralizing judgment from his kind of oracular pronouncements.
What, there's no, he didn't see the technology itself as being moral or immoral. He didn't point at the box, the TV, and say this is an entirely good thing or an entirely bad thing. He had nothing to say about that.
And it's where, you know, to me, I think it's important that, you know, he's in touch with the eternal. He's a real believer in a very deep and rich theological tradition. So what happens in the temporal world is really, you know, kind of minor and fleeting to him. He was always trying to get you to think about media as environment and bracket off what it was you were receiving from it. So how can you kind of foreground what it is you're not seeing is the whole, you know, sort of key to his art. And it really is an art form, what he does. He's an artist. Whether he was a great one or not, it'll take us a little bit while longer to figure out, but that's the key thing.
He was arguably a pretty impressive visionary. I've got a, you know, quote from him. The next medium, whatever it is, it may be the extension of consciousness, will include television as its content, not as its environment, and will transform television into an art form. A computer as a research and communication instrument could enhance retrieval. It could obsolesce mass library organization, retrieve the individual's encyclopedic function, and flip into a private line to a speedily tailored data of a saleable kind. He says that in 1962. Wow, that's amazing, Ken. That's so bang on. That's a great description of what the internet has become.
It is pretty spot on. I mean, he also thought that the hologram was going to be a popular media, so it's not like he got everything right.
Give it time. Give it time. You never know.
Yeah. But the thing about prophecy is not to get the details right, but to get you to think about the relation between past, present, and future. And that was one thing he was very good at.
What do you think he got wrong, apart from holograms?
The sort of the dark side to McLuhan is the politics of race plays out in a fairly unpleasant way. And this is, I think, one of the reasons he falls out of favour in the 70s.
Oh dear, really? Yeah. What does he say?
You really can't, in the 60s, make pronouncements about, you know, the white man is this, but the black man is that, you know. And he thought television was going to re-tribalise us back to a world in which we live mythically and in depth. And that, and I'm using his language, you know, the Negro is someone who automatically already lives in that space. And you sort of think, what? Are you kidding? Have you spoken to any African-Americans about that little pet theory? So there's a sense in which that, you know, this the sort of this is where he was not able to see figure and ground. He was sort of repeating these figures from a culture he'd inherited and not seeing the ground of how things like politics of race are created, not least in media. So there's certain things on which he was not a good guy.
Yeah, well, that's exactly wrong on that. It hasn't re-tribalised everyone at all. It's just done just the opposite. I can still recall going to Marrakesh in Morocco, going into my hotel room and getting the Cartoon Network from an American cable channel there, and I thought, that's weird. I mean, Marrakesh, where this kind of thing has happened. He was exactly wrong, it would seem, now, Ken, about
well, that. Yes and no, but the thing is that if you sort of peel that statement that I was just paraphrasing off the, and it's an oxymoron, although we don't see it as that, of global village, right? Those two words are not supposed to go together. Like, global's not a modifier for village. Village is, by definition, local, right? But what he's saying is that media are going to change the boundaries between inside and outside, here and there. Like, that's what he's really drawing attention to. But some of the language he used to do it is just language that's already not acceptable in the 60s. And not in any moralistic sense, but just it's not thinking language, right? But if you take it out of that context and go, global village, inside and outside, you know, so I can still inhabit, you know, a village that I live in Brooklyn, even though I'm on the other side of the planet by text messaging. You know, that's the sort of thing he wants you to pay attention to. And that's the McLuhan, I think, that's worth remembering.
Just finally, you've been living in New York City for over a decade now. And in a way, New York City is the home of old media, publishing, magazines, radio, some television. But just tell me what the environment's like in as far as media in New York at the moment. Are things pretty gloomy there?
You notice in Woody Allen films, everybody's apartment has miles of bookshelves and you know, people have liaisons that take place in bookstores and all this kind of stuff. And I kind of suspect it wasn't even true in Woody Allen's day that, you know, New York was quite this, you know, sort of weirdly cultured little zone. But the thing is, yeah, it's a city that now belongs to the old world, I think, is the kind of paradox of of New York.
When you mean like Paris, then?
Yeah, like that. Yeah, like paradoxically, even though it's technically in the new world, it's part of the old world. And of course, we all live in the shadow of the finance industry, and like loose change falls out of the pockets of bankers at Goldman Sachs, and we all like snatch it up off the pavement and survive off it, kind of thing. So there's that side of it. But apart from that, New York, you think about New York, you think about the publishing industry, you think about, you know, Madison Avenue, old-fashioned advertising. You think about, you know, Columbia University. You think about all these things that are very much kind of old media sorts of spaces. The magazine business is still sort of magazines, you know. That those sorts of things are still kind of headquartered there. So it's kind of strange. People still kind of flock to it wanting some kind of culture, but I suspect it's one that's, you know, kind of fading and trying desperately to reinvent itself in another space.
Ken, it's great to see you again after all these years, and great to have you back in Australia. Thanks for being my guest today in Conversations.
Thank you, Richard. A pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.